he, you know, saw the paste, which comes out of what looks like a syringe, and we load up the various different points underneath the device that you're mounting, whether it's a 4-pin dip or a SIP rather, or a 64-pin VLSI that you're putting down. And you basically make a mess, and then what you do, the darn thing that finds the mess becomes, you know, it heats up enough, and it does a really beautiful job, and then you just let it cool off and wash it off, K2IWK2J.
Eric, when you use this syringe, are you putting down just flux, or is it flux with particles of solder, so that when you heat up the whole process, the flux is doing the remaining cleaning of the surfaces, and does it become the solder itself, or do you have to touch it with the tin antimony solder? How do you actually do that process? And if they can only take 6 or 7 seconds of the high temperature, and if you're doing this with a heat gun, I'm having a little trouble believing that you can heat up a whole printed circuit board with all of your components glued down in that brief a time and get all those good joints. Give me a few more words on that one, Eric, go ahead.
All right, first of all, if you're using a heat gun or, you know, a hot air soldering station, or what they call a rework station, you're talking about a very little area. You're not talking about the entire board. You can take your oven at home. You can, with glue, populate an entire board of surface mount material. You can then heat up your oven to, I think, what is it, 450 degrees Celsius, or 350 degrees Celsius. Make sure it's at that temperature, okay? And actually, you'll find there are a lot of ovens that are convection, because you need the moving air. And put that entire board in the oven for, I think, what it is, because of the thermodynamic laws, it takes time for the stuff to get hot. I don't remember. I think it's like 30 or 45 seconds. I have to look it up. And that will solder the entire board. You take it out very carefully because, you know, the stuff is molten. A couple seconds for it to cool down, and you have a complete board. So, but when you're using a rework station, you basically, you're holding the pipe down, and you point at it until you see the stuff melt and you're done, which is usually about 2 or 3 seconds, that's all. Depends upon what flux the solder paste I'm using. If you're using they make a leaded solder paste, and that has a built-in water solid flux. There's various different kinds. There's a solder paste that's, lead-free. And for some reason, they don't put the flux in that, but there's a carrier in that. But you have to keep this stuff in the refrigerator because it goes bad for a while. And actually, the syringes of solder paste is dated, so you know what, it's getting old. When I'm using the lead-free stuff, I will put, with another syringe, put down over the pads this water-soluble flux. Then I put down a little string of the actual solder paste, place the component on the pad, hold it down, heat it up. K2IWK2J.
GDH with a comment? Sounds like GDH. We'll get to you in a second. Eric, have you done lead-free soldering with a solder iron? I think the answer is yes. Do you find it more difficult to get proper wetting of the leads being brought together that are being soldered with the lead-free solder, with the proper flux? Or do you think that it's almost the identical skill, or is there a new learning curve there? Over to you, Eric.
Yeah, as long as the soldering iron is hot enough, there's no new learning curve. Although, it doesn't flow as nicely as the lead-free solder, but I think you get used to that instantly.
Okay. It sounded like GDH. Give me your full call letter, sir. Give me your name, and then proceed you with your question or comment.
I'm sorry, Dick. It's Victor David Henry, John. I was just thinking about that device that was in QST. I think it was about 3 or 4, maybe 5 QSTs ago. I think it was called the Beast, an acronym for something, but it was essentially a homebrew surface mount rework station that had a hot air soldering component, a camera, which gave an image on a large screen TV for old eyes like mine, as well as a hold down tool for surface mount components. And I think in there they described that process with that solder paste. Go ahead, Dick.
Sounds pretty good. Eric, you've on a couple of occasions said that you take each of the components and glue them down after first, I guess, putting down some flux and solder paste in the places where you want soldering to take place. What do you use for glue? How much does it cost? Where do you buy it? How long does it take to cure? Is it just a sticky substance to make sure that the component doesn't pop and go to some other place by the tiddlywink process, or is it a real gluing process? Give us a few more words on the way you glue down, say, for instance, a multi-pinned integrated circuit or a surface mount resistor. How do you actually do that gluing, Eric? Go ahead.
All right. Well, I tend not to glue it down unless it's a big chip that's a pain in the neck holding in one place. But if you've ever looked at any mass manufactured surface mount boards, you usually find like a little red dot underneath the component when you
finally fly away from the board. 30.
See, when you're manufacturing in large scale and you have a parts placement machine, it actually puts a little drop of glue there, places the part, because you've already used what's called a solder mask, which is basically a silk screen that is an image of all the pads that you want to have flux and solder on, and just put the board down, and you squeegee this flux and this solder mixture onto the board. Then the board goes into the part placing machine, and what it will do is put a teeny little drop of what appears to be like nail polish on the center of the component, slab it down there, and by the time it finishes placing all the components, that glue has dried. Now that board is unsoldered, it has the flux and everything on it, and it goes into an oven, in essence, that it passes over, which then melts the whole mess, and you wind up with a completely soldered board, and in theory, it all is exactly in the right place. So, but I tend to use the regular nail polish. I don't go out and buy the special glue. And I take a big chip, get it wet, line it up, let it dry, and it makes alignment so much easier, because as this stuff begins to harden, you can move things carefully and have it stay put. K2R, K2J.
Okay, RYY, recognize. I could ask you for a couple extra words on this one now. Do you literally go out and buy a bottle of clear nail polish? And is that what you use for holding down an integrated circuit? And when you want to glue down a 603 or a 402 resistor, what do you do to glue that down, Eric? Go ahead.
First of all, I don't like working with anything smaller than 1206, but sometimes I have no choice. So, that's just the reality of it. No, I get my nail polish from the wife, so I just take it out of the medicine cabinet. But as far as the components that small, I have a little thing which is sort of like fingers. I have a gizmo that you position the board on. I have a board preheater, which actually brings the board temperature up to about 120 degrees, which cuts down on the amount of time that it takes for the solder to melt. And I have these little pieces of, think of as barbecue sticks or what do you call them? When you put all the pieces of meat and everything on it, my brain isn't functioning now, but And alligator clips, and I basically position it and hold it down. I also have a little vacuum operator tool for things that small, for 402s and 608s, that those size components. And you basically position it, heat it up, and move on to the next one. So, you know, you could, in fact, glue the dies down, but you need, like, you really need a hypodermic needle point to apply the glue, that's for sure. You don't want it to spread onto where the actual contacts are, because that's going to make a real mess. KE2RW,
KE2J. AC2QIQ with a comment.
Okay, we got Joe and Glenn in that order. There is a modeling shop that's adjacent to the laboratory where I work during the day, and a bunch of very skilled ladies will put down 201s, 402s, 603s, and they do some kind of a gluing process to hold the component in place before they do the soldering operation, the manual soldering, when they're making specials, when they're making onesies and twosies. I'm going to find out tomorrow how they actually do that. Joe was the next person who signed in, W2RYY. Go ahead, Joe.
Thank you. I believe the stuff you're talking about is called Glyptol. I think it's either G-L-Y-T-O-L or G-Y-L-T-O-L. Check the spelling, but if you put that name in on Google, you're going to come up with what I think it is. It's a red type of stuff that uses to seal different things. I know when I worked in one place a long, long time ago, they used it in the calibration lab to seal devices or components as they calibrate, like, you know, shafts and different things or whatever. It just, like, it sets very hard and very quickly. So a drop of that, like an end of a toothpick, would probably be exactly what you're looking for.
Yeah, I wonder if I could get away with this white glue stick that people use for holding down papers, for gluing pieces of paper together. I wonder if a tiny toothpick worth of that. And by the way, the word you were looking for earlier, Eric, was shish kebab stick. There's all kinds of little stickers you can buy in food stores for skewing food. And various people have made devices that will be spring-loaded and apply pressure to a component to hold it in position on top of a PC board in the right place while you do soldering. Let's see how Glenn does it. What do you use for glue, Glenn? Do you have a holding device? Do you use shish kebab sticks? Or, let's see, what do I use? At the place where I work, they've got these great big long cotton swabs. It's a cotton swab on a stick that's about 8 inches long. Well, I tend to tape together with Scotch tape a pair of those cotton swab sticks end to end, so I get a stick that's about 15 inches long, and I put the various sizes of pieces of copper tape on the end of the stick, fastened in various ways, and these are my tuning tools for the UHF antennas. And people have taken pictures of me doing this tuning process, and if they're not RF people, they think it's strange, and they said, boy, that must be a black art that you're processing. And I say, yes, it is. KC2QIQ, K2RIW, you got it, Glenn.
Very good, Dick. The glues that are typically used are what they call epoxide resins. They're readily available in a lot of places that sell soldering supplies, mainly like Arrow Electronics and other things like that. You can find, I think even if you go to like Newark and a lot of the other ones that are available, you can get where you can get your soldering supplies. Any good surface mount epoxide resin will work very, very well. And they're typically used inside of, like, applicators, normally, like, pressure-fed. What's very, very good is a syringe. You can also get the syringes from these electronic supply houses, where they basically just, you put basically a canister of this stuff inside the little syringe, and you kind of just press on it a little bit, and it puts a little dot underneath the surface. And then you can take a pair of tweezers, place your component, and then it's nice and rigid. Now when you bring over your soldering iron, it makes a very, very simple connection. Just another quick comment about soldering with surface mount and, you know, using these new lead-free solders. There are components now that are rated for soldering at higher temperatures. The melting temperature of this is like 217°C, and basically a good surface mount Rojas component is rated at 260 to 280. The better ones are the 280 degree components. And the ones you really have to be careful of is capacitors. When soldering older equipment, the things you have to watch out are like paper component PC boards. and paper capacitors and things like that, because they don't take too well to higher temperatures of this stuff. K4IW, KC2QIQ.
These epoxied resin and little syringes for applying it for surface mount components. Do you believe, Eric, Glenn, I could walk into Radio Shack and buy some of those products? Can I also buy soldering paste in a syringe? Does Radio Shack have any of this to your knowledge? Over to you, Glenn.
One day, but not today.
Well, let's put it this way. My disappointment in Radio Shack has been pretty high. I mean, just even trying to get a good set of connectors in there anymore, it's unreliable. It wouldn't be my first choice. I really don't think that they have it. Any really good, the type of soldering materials and irons and things that you'll find in Radio Shack will be for your leaded solder. You're not going to find much in there that's for anything Rojas. Your best bet is to find like a good electronic supply house, you know, like a commercial supply house like Arrow, or go ahead with Newark, or you know, the usual electronic supply places. You can actually type those in on Google and get there, or you can actually order their catalogs, and you can get, you know, real, you know, soldering supplies and, you know, do it the right way. K4IW, KC2QIQ.
I think it was Eric that had a further comment about Radio Shack not having it. Go ahead, Eric.
You know, Radio Shack is going to be like 5 or 6 years behind for that kind of stuff. So, you know, a surface mount, not something you can even think about. Unleaded solder, that doesn't even happen at this point. But you'll probably see unleaded solder show up there in the next year, I guess. But that's just a guess on my point.
Okay. Anybody have any further questions or comments on this subject before we go on to, I think it's Rich is waiting all this time, N2EO. Anyone else with any further questions or comments on what we've talked up till now?
Yeah, this is K2KEY. One word about surface mounting.
Go ahead, Eric. Mel. And by the way, if I know you, you found some little gadget that somebody sells that clamps onto the printed circuit board, like, what do you call these now, virtual clips, or, you know what I mean? A device you squeeze, it opens up the drawers, it clamps onto the PC board, and it's got some kind of a springy device, and it comes out and holds down your component before you solder it. I'll bet you own something like that. Over to you, Mel.
Okay, very good. Yeah, I've got the simplest thing of all. I use two chopsticks. Basically, I got two chopsticks that are held together with rubber bands. And if you twist the rubber bands correctly in the way the chopsticks come together at one end, they will, stick it into a little piece of wood on the bottom, a little base. The chopstick will actually be able to exert pressure on a surface-mounted component, and let you solder it up. Now, if you want to remove, say, a resistor or a capacitor, one of these little ones, simplest way to do it, I found. I got this little pair of tweezers, you know, one of the pair that works the opposite. In other words, when you squeeze at the back, it opens. So let's go with the two tips come together. I put that on. I have a rubber band that goes through the jaw of it, and I hold the rubber band in my mouth, believe it or not, and I use two little soldering iron, pencil iron, heat up both sides, pull my head up, and lift the little component straight up thick. Do it with a lot of different components, but this way you got your third hand, over.
Yeah, they make a kind of a dual soldering iron, which has got the almost like a scissor arrangement where you can adjust the spacing between the two tips of the soldering iron, and you heat up both ends of a resistor simultaneously. The only other approach is to use solder stick and get rid of all the solder on one side and then eventually unsolder the other side. Removing a surface mount component without the right tools is a fairly homely process, I'll warn you. Eric does it right with the right kind of vacuuming tools and so on. These surface mount components and super miniature sizes, they're here to stay. My favorite way of doing all of this work is with a Bausch & Lomb Zoom stereo microscope. There's just no other way to me. I've watched people do it with jeweler's loops and things that wear on the head and whatever, and a large magnifying glass with a ring light. None of that comes close. None of that comes close to what you can do with a real good zoom microscope. I was lucky enough to buy one used at a surplus house in Utica, New York, when I was there, and I paid $150 for the darn thing, and wow. With the right kind of fiber optic lighting from the two sides, left and right side, simultaneously at board levels, so you see lots of shadow-like areas, so you can really see the third dimension, and you're getting a color, zoom, stereographic, binaural vision, if you know what I mean, stereo vision of what you're working on, and you can adjust the gain. Everyone thinks that a microscope should have a magnifying power of a zillion. People will try to buy a microscope with 150. You only need 30. 30 is plenty. And maybe you zoom up to 50 or 60 occasionally, but or maybe 80, but 20 or 30 is all you really need. That's when you've got the right kind of stereo vision and the right kind of lighting. It allows you to really see what's going on at the board level, whether or not you've got a cold joint. Rich, I think you had a question. N2EO, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, I'm the one that, you already picked me up, Dick. I'm the one that asked the question on ROAS concerning lead-free solder. By the way, I've seen in RadioShack.com, they do already sell at Radio Shack lead-free solder, Dick.
I wonder if you've seen any of the other tools required for soldering and desoldering and solder pasting and gluing or whatever. You keep track of Radio Shack a little better than the rest of us. Have you seen anything like that in their catalogs, Rich? Go ahead.
I have not, Dick, but I really haven't looked. I did note the saying, you know, that you can wash boards with water. You don't need the, you know, like we stated earlier, you don't need the flux removal like the rosin flux on the leaded solder. That's the way they're pushing it. But I've used Radio Shack soldering irons, and they're pretty bad.
I hear you. Okay. I guess you're saying you don't go there for the Cadillac products. I wonder if Paul is available, WS2N. I didn't hear him sign in tonight. He's our space expert. I'd like to know what NASA is doing. WS2N, if you're there, Paul, K2RIW. Okay. Is there anyone else out of area that wants to sign in? Give us your call letters right now. Looks like the answer is no. I think we've handled everyone who signed in with a question or a comment. Tonight, so far, we've gone through quite a bit of digital television, antennas, surface mount component, Rojas solder, soldering and desoldering techniques, gluing techniques, and my comments on the right kind of a microscope to do this work. Mel, I wonder what kind of mail you've had this week, and they're always angry at us. I don't have to ask you if they're angry at us. What have we done wrong this week, Mel? K2KEY, K2RIW.
This is K2KEY. Well, I told you I got a very sharp filter, so I skip over when I start to see some of the so-called ridiculous comments that I'm not going to answer them anymore. We've said this many a time. The price is right, so you you can go for that same price. You can go elsewhere. Anyhow, let's take things. Now, I get a lot of great, believe me, Dick, get a tremendous amount of compliments, tremendous amount. They outweigh the controversial type of ridiculous statements, some of them, by, I'd say, 50 to 1, maybe 75 to 1, maybe 100 to 1. So I don't even be concerned about it anymore. This is a question here I have that has come up many times. You've mentioned many a time that you used copper wire that you bought and rolled, you picked up and everything. You've gone to the so-called big box store, another name for Home Depot. Let me let it drop. And I see, I'm very confused. They said here they have wire that has THHN type, copper wire. What is the THHN? Is it, what is kind of insulation in it? Is it, and how does this insulation really affect the length of dipoles, for instance, when you cut them? How do I figure in the insulation factor, and is it a factor, over?
Okay, now, when you buy modern Romex-like wiring, plastic sheath wiring, your two, three, or four leads of your power wiring is contained in a gray or a white outer plastic oblong elliptical cross-section thing, and when you cut that away, each individual lead has red, black, or white rubber on top of the copper itself. I know for a fact that on most of the HF frequencies, whether or not you leave on the red, black, or white rubber covering on the copper wire does not matter. Now, you might decide to strip it away because you want the wire to have a little bit less weight, a little bit less wind load. Other people will leave on the rubber wiring because they think it's going to give them a more slippery surface, and therefore the wiring will do a better job of shedding the ice on a winter day. There's controversy there as to what's the best way to go. Radio-wise, at HF frequencies, that radio wave doesn't see that insulation. It goes down through the insulation, waits till it hits the copper, and then it does its conducting thing. So for the most part, the rubber insulation on the wire does nothing radio-wise. There's a catch. Let me drop. And that is K6YNB, I think it was. Can't think of his name right now. The guy who invented the Quad Yagi. Quad.
We're back.
What's his name again? Wayne Overbeck. What's Wayne Overbeck's call letters? Yep.
6MYC, but that's Mike Stoll. You got me, Dick.
Okay, the person who's talking now, telling me it's N6NB, was K6YNB. I'm hearing you on the input, but you must not have PL, you're not coming through the machine. Out of curiosity, who are you? Okay, I think that's W2TTT. And I'm hearing him on the input, but he's probably got the PL set for New Jersey, not for Long Island, so he's not coming. Yeah, Wayne Overbeck, the Quad Yagi. Wayne discovered, much to his displeasure, that the guys in Germany who were building his Quad Yagis, who were building the driven element on 432 megacycles, leaving the rubber on their wire, and their wire wasn't 14 gauge, it was X number of millimeter, the typical European way. And he found out that when the rubber was left on, the driven element was tuned to a lower frequency than when the rubber was taken off. So at 432, the rubber does make a difference on a Quad Yagi driven element. For most of us on HF frequencies, I think the rubber doesn't matter. But after some measurements, people may find that out. I was reading the ARRL antenna book today, and there's a section in there that really bothers me. And that is where there's a section with a great big fancy graph showing you that the length of your guy wires will hit certain resonant frequencies, and they led you to believe that unless you put a zillion egg insulators all over the place on your guy wires, that the resonance of the guy wires at HF frequencies are going to give you all kinds of grief as far as disturbing the pattern of your antenna is concerned. They did say that the change in gain and the change in standing wave ratio is not significant, but the front-to-side, front-to-back ratio will be changed, and they're recommending that you put a whole bunch of egg insulators. I'm strongly against that for two reasons. Number one, in the process of installing all those egg insulators, that's a lot of extra hardware that has to be maintained, and failure of that hardware can take place. And I will tell you for sure, if the guy wires in your tower fail, life gets very complicated real fast. You don't want that to happen. Second of all, if you are absolutely positively sure that your guy wire is going to hit resonance, that it is so darn easy to kill the resonance by putting objects on the guy wire itself. In other words, at a strategic place, if I connect a piece of wire with a guy clip, and I bring that piece of wire off to one side, and it adds extra capacitance, inductance, or whatever, I can kill that resonance. I'd much rather see a person kill the resonance that happens to occur as opposed to making all of these extra pieces of hardware to do that. But that's off subject. Mel's original subject was about the rubber. And when it comes to the way the Romex is packaged originally with all the leads parallel to each other, and there are people who have tried to make a fan dipole out of that, that's putting the individual resonators, the individual radiators, much too close. So one way or another, the outer gray or white composite rubber, I'm pretty sure you're going to remove that. But whether or not the black, red, or white rubber inside you remove, I think that's your choice. That's my opinion. Other people will probably get other opinions. K2KEY to take it with a little bit of delay, if anyone wants to put in their word than this one.
Repeater, timeout.
Get the tone set up now, W2TTT.
Yeah, now you've got to correct that, Gordon. Go ahead, Gordon, if you want to say some more. You're coming through the machine now.
Yeah, I'm just going to add something into this little mix. You know, the insulation question, you know, around wire and stuff, you're right, doesn't seem to matter as much at the lower frequencies, but I've even seen things like where you build a simple, you know, J-pole, either out of copper or out of a twin lead, you stick it inside of a piece of PVC and magically it doesn't work anymore with the right SWR. So think about that. Let's talk more about that when the appropriate time. Let's dispense with their other parts.
Yeah, I'm going to say a couple of words on that one. A J-pole antenna is a kind of a dipole that you feed at the outer end. If you feed a dipole in the center, the impedance is somewhere around 70 ohms. If you feed the dipole from one end, a perfectly valid thing to do, and an efficient thing to do. That's the good news. The bad news is you're feeding an impedance of around 1,000 or 1,500 ohms. And so the J-pole mechanism handles that for you. It's an impedance step-up device. Or the coil you've got in the base of your 5/8 wave mag mount antenna, it's another impedance stepping up device. It does that. And so when you're feeding an impedance as high as 1,500 ohms, I can see how local PVC adds some extra capacitance, and unless you readjust the lens accordingly, it could create a detuning. That's my guess. What do you think, Gordon?
Yeah, I'm inclined to agree with you. There's no question about it. I'm going to go into HT listening mode because I now have lightning overhead. So, but thank you, Dick, and it's always a pleasure to listen to the net. W2TTT.
I presume you're at home because you sound real good. Sometimes from your automobile, you're a little bit more noisy. And I'm hearing thunder in the background also. But the particular tower I'm transmitting from right now is the lower of the two towers on my property. Therefore, in theory, I'm lightning protected. If I suddenly go off, you know why. Back to you, Mel. K2KEY. Have you ever left the rubber on? In fact, the green dipole you've got in your front yard, the vertical antenna. In order for it to be green, I think the rubber is there. K2KEY, K2RIW.
This is K2KEY. Yeah, well, I bought the roll of wire, as I said. It was, you know, very cheap. I didn't buy it at Home Depot or electrical supply place. It was a place where they were auctioning off all kinds of stuff. And I saw rolls of wire. I got a roll of white, I got a roll of black, I got a roll of green. You know, these were 500-foot rolls. And they were somewhat messed up. They were, you know, they're metal reels, and it looks like they got bounced around. So it looked kind of messy looking. So I didn't have any takers. I gave a couple of bucks each and took it away. And, of course, I've used quite a bit of it for antennas. I will say one thing. Now, should I say this is the gospel or not? I think that the insulation, I'm going to make a statement, I think that it has what they call THHN, it says on there, is nylon over PVC, I believe, insulation. I think that's what they call that. That's for household electrical wiring, you know, to be put in conduits and things like that. I think, maybe I'm wrong, that it does change the resonant frequency of the dipole by a few percent. I think you have to shorten the dipole a few percent, Dick. Am I right or wrong? I, for some reason, I feel this is what I've found, that it does create that problem. Over.
EC2 QIQ. Glenn recognized that even if it did, Mel, the Sirius amateur owns some kind of a standing wave ratio measuring equipment, a bird wattmeter or whatever. He can sweep across his favorite band. He can get that famous bathtub-shaped curve and decide that his antenna is tuned high or low. So correcting the lens, I think, is fairly easy. Glenn probably knows what THHN stands for. You got it, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2LIW, and the TechNet.
I'm sorry, this, Dick, to disappoint, but actually I don't. But just a comment to what Mel was saying. I'm not sure. Actually, this is kind of a question and an observation. I noticed when I was doing my full wave loop at on 80 meters, it was around 275 feet, approximately. And what I did was I initially had a 4-to-1 balun, and I ran the wire around, and I adjusted the length with just bare copper wire initially. And later on, I came up with a an insulation around a different wire that was a little bit heavier gauge, and I ran that around, and I replaced it. But before I put it back up again, I carefully laid it out next to the other wire, and as I went around the loop with it, and it, so I could keep the length as close as I possibly could to the original length. And what I found out was that after attaching it, I had to really shorten it with the same balun by almost like a foot and a half to 2 feet. You know, it was like, I mean, I took a pretty nice sized chunk of wire off there and retune it again so it would match. It was kind of interesting. Now, I'm wondering, do you think that might just be wire gauge, the insulation, or is it maybe also that the, you know, the impedance of a loop isn't 75 ohms, it's a bit higher? K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Almost any of us have put up an HF antenna. If we're really serious and you don't want your antenna tuner to have to work real hard, we'd like to resonate the antenna itself. You don't have to, but you'd like to. And the environment you put the antenna into, I think, also makes a big difference. How close is the nearest to trees and house and gutters and downspouts and wiring of the house itself. I mean, our eye sees a house and we say, gee, it's usually made out of insulating materials. Well, if you had Superman's X-ray eyes, you would see that there's all kinds of conduit pipes and 110-volt and 220-volt wiring. There's all kinds of metallic objects in the house. So those nearby objects are other detuning. Now, in order for you to hit resonance on your antenna at a point that made you happy, with the right instrumentation, with the right attitude, I'll bet you did that whole process in roughly an hour. Is that true, Glenn? Go ahead.
I would say that the tuning, Dick, probably took me about maybe 15, 20 minutes tops. You know, the whole work was, you know, really putting up the antenna itself and, you know, getting it all wrapped around and fastened properly and, you know, hooking up the transmission line and getting the balun all mounted properly. So that's where all the effort and time is. But the actual tuning with a good little MFJ antenna analyzer, if it added an extra 15 minutes, that was it. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
I just did a Google of THHN, Mel, and it says here that it stands for thermoplastic high heat-resistant nylon. So thermoplastic high heat-resistant nylon coated can be in stranded or solid, aluminum or copper, and they make it sound like it's becoming the standard for both industrial and private homes. I think the amount of detuning that THHN will give to a dipole is relatively small. And so with your ability to retune, and do you really want to leave it on? Do you want to experience the extra wind resistance? The THHN coating, to my knowledge, is not adding a considerable amount of strength to the antenna compared to the copper that's on the inside. I think a 97% of your strength is coming from the copper. But the insulating material on the outside is definitely increasing wind resistance. And now you could justify leaving it if you think it would be better at shedding ice. I wonder. I think the ice would stick to it almost as well as it would stick to the stranded copper or the solid copper. But here I'm not sure. K2KEY, K2RIW.
K2QIQ.
Go ahead, Glenn.
It's just funny that you mentioned about taking the coating off of the wire. It was something I certainly thought about doing when I hung up the wire. The reason I left it off initially with that configuration, I don't use that configuration anymore, but it was just funny that at the time I left it on because initially I was going to try to strip off some of the rubber insulation. And after about 5 feet, I was like, oh, forget it. It was just too much aggravation to work, and the chance of actually damaging the wire while trying to strip it off. So I just kind of left it on and then cut it for the right length. That was kind of my experience there. And then after that, I've kind of been using different wire, you know, other than insulated wire since. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
What I think you're saying, Glenn, is that the insulation is very tough to remove. However, your big box store sells a device that you can scrape across a wire, and it cuts down through the insulation without damaging the wire on the inside. If you drew that along the length, I suspect the stripping process would go a lot easier. If you had that particular tool, and if it was easy enough to strip away the wire, do you think you would have done it, Glenn? Over to you, Glenn.
I think what I've done, Dick, is just gone out and got the spool of wire that doesn't have the rubber insulation on it anymore. I don't know whether this is, you know, like Mel says, whether this is very good information or not, but that particular antenna with that, even though the wire gauge was a little thicker, it just never performed as well. It's hard for me to put my finger on. It just always seemed to have a little bit more noise in the background, and the signal to noise on the antenna wasn't as good as just using nice, like I have wire up there now that's, I believe, it's 14-gauge wire. And the application of that wire was the magnetic, like, transformer wire that you produce transformers with. But is the insulation really causing the issue? I'm not sure, you know, there again. And I still think even with a tool, maybe if short distances of the wire, it may not be a problem. But to do, you know, like 275 feet, that can be a pretty large extra job in putting up the antenna or additional prep that I think could be spent elsewhere better. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
HMM with a comment.
Okay, Mr. HMM. That sounds like Charlie. Go right ahead, Charlie.
WA2HMM Mobile. All my HF antennas except for the beam are using 14-gauge THHN. It will reduce the length of the dipole or inverted V by a couple percent. And the nice thing about it is if you string it between the trees, it does not allow, it helps prevent arcing to the trees. So that's the niceness about using the THHN. Go ahead.
Sounds like you like it. And I can see how the arcing to the tree could be a problem. When you've had the non-rubber-coated wire in the past, Charlie, and you did hear arcing to the tree, did that make noise on reception, make noise on transmission? How did you know that arcing to the tree was taking place, and what disadvantage did that give you? Back to you, Charlie.
Well, bottom line, you could wind up setting a tree on fire, which you really wouldn't want. Whoops, yeah, you really wouldn't want to set a tree on fire. And, yeah, I guess you could probably see sparking or something like that, but then again, I do run a kilowatt on a low band.
And that kilowatt is capable of making a lot more heat in that tree. Okay. So that's an interesting advantage. Stops the arcing, or just about stops the arcing to the tree. And in your case, the green insulation, I guess, stops any arcing to your, well, you don't run high power, but still it would stop any arcing to your evergreen that you've got in front of your property, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Yeah, Roger, this is K2KEY. Well, I do. I run a kilowatt many times, most of the time on 75 meters. You got to run a kilowatt usually to get over the noise level. So I've had no problems with that THHN. And I left the insulation on. To me, the insulation protects the wire from the weather. I think that is very good for, you know, preserving the length of, preserving the wire quality much longer. However, you know, something that Glenn said also rings a bell. I had a lot of that copper weld wire before that. I wound up and I cut it up so many times, and all finally was nothing really usable anymore. And I think, I don't know why, but I think in a couple of dipoles that I had used, for instance, with copper welds, that something, is it my imagination, because it's supposedly quality, more of a quality wire, that maybe it worked better. But I could say for sure that I had to change the length of the dipole, and I think it seems to show always that it lowers the resonant frequency, the insulation. It seems like that is, seems to be sticking in my back of my mind, that you have a couple of percent of lowering the resonant frequency if you leave the insulation on, Dick. Over.
Well, that's absolutely true. Yeah, I'm going to agree with that. Both Charlie is saying it and Mel saying it. I'm going to agree with it. The insulation will lower the frequency, and you're about to ask how. A little bit of extra N capacitance, but that's not the biggie. The signal traveling along the wire is trying to hug the wire as close as it can. That insulation probably has a dielectric constant of, let's call it 3, even though it's very thin wavelength-wise. It's there. If it was so-called G-line, and you were doing this at microwave frequencies, you could launch a signal onto that wire, and with that layer of insulation on top, it would be a kind of almost shielded transmission line. So at microwave frequencies, without a doubt, but even at HF frequencies, your velocity of propagation along that wire with the insulation is going to be slower. Now, is it 1% slower or 3% slower? Don't know, but it's slower. So I believe that, and so therefore, when you make yourself a dipole out of wire with the insulation on it, in general, you're going to end up a little bit long, and to cut it shorter after you did some tuning testing, it's relatively easy, in my opinion. It's in the right direction. If you had to add length to the end, things are a little bit more complicated. It's not quite as neat an arrangement when you've got to twist another piece of wire on the end and hope it's all going to hold together right. So, since it only takes us a small number of minutes, a small fraction of an hour, to check the tuning of a dipole after you construct it and put it in place, and depending on how your halyards are set up so it's easy to get to, I don't think that's a big disadvantage. A serious guy is going to want to check the tuning of his antenna. A not-so-serious guy says, gee, my antenna tuner handles it, why worry about it? K2KEY, K2RIW.
Says K2KEY again. Okay, no, I'm just answering a question here that was posed to us here, that whether or not that wire is what I was talking about. I guess, yeah, I guess it will be excellent. It's cheap, it's reasonable, it's easy to obtain, and I think for dipoles, as far as I'm concerned, I also have a, you know, full wave loop and all. I also have the dipole for 160 meters. These are long antennas, you know, long, a lot of wire, and I have performed quite well. I've run a kilowatt, a kilowatt. I'll be conservative and say I run only a kilowatt into it with no problem whatsoever. All right, now getting to the next thing you had mentioned, controversy with Guywire. All right. Yeah, first, anybody want to say anything more about this before we get into World War III? Over.
Mr. Quickie, I got a sign, guys. WA2HMM, I'm gone. See you tomorrow, Nick.
Very fine, Charlie. You said that just a quickie. Is there something else you'd like to say, Charlie? And so, go ahead.
Oh, the quickie was I got a sign. Boss lady wants me to unload the truck. WA2HMM, I'm clear.
Okay, we're going to give you permission to drop out. See you tomorrow, Charlie. You got it, Mel. What's the next controversy? Oh, guy wires and killing the resonance. I'd much rather kill the resonance if I found one rather than put in all those egg insulators ahead of time. But that's just me. And the Philly strand technique or the insulated guy wires, I'm not in favor of those. I just don't think they're as reliable. Thank you, Mel.
Hey, I just finished a major project on the tower. In fact, I've been doing that, working on that the whole month of July, whatever the weather was permitting, and I could put in a number of hours, and I finished a big job on the tower. One of the jobs that I did this time was to replace the guy wires, and all the guy wires on my tower are broken up with egg insulators. And it is a job to cut the old stuff loose from the egg insulators to try to salvage them, because the price of those strain type air insulators have gone very high. In fact, the whole thing has gone high. The why I tried salvaging them after what I had to pay for a guy wire was outrageous, and the buckles and everything. But this came up one night. We had this discussion. It started on 75 meters, and boy, did the horror stories start. It was one after another. In fact, the ARRL in the antenna book has a chunk of information on that where they warn you, and that if you don't put guy, you know, egg insulators, your guy wires, your tower, oh, what's going to happen? So let me tell you, if you came on 75 meters and said that, well, don't worry about it until you have a problem, and then it's very easy to fix the problem. Well, let me tell you, you should have heard the horror stories. It was unbelievable, Dick. I could give you a sample of some of them, and you could either laugh them off or pretend I'm serious. Over.
Okay. Describe what you heard, Mel. What do they believe was the greatest disadvantage of a resonating guy wire? And were they smart enough to know how to kill the resonance rather than change the whole living daylights out of the physical layout of the system? Go ahead.
I remember one guy was telling us about this TVI problem that was on way, no way that they could lick the TVI problems until some genius came along. He's up in Massachusetts, and he took a look at his tower set up and his antenna set up, and he says, I know where your problem is. And he says, what? He says, it's your guy wires that are causing you trouble. And they started all, he started to laugh. He says, what's wrong with my guy wires? It's top quality, blah, blah, blah. He says, you didn't break them up, and that's why you got the TVI. He says, I was so desperate, he says, already, that I was one step away from, he says, they're really taking the whole thing down and putting it away, scrapping it. And he says, all right, I went this far already. He says, I went and bought egg insulators with the clamps and the whole business. And he says, I followed the ARRL in the book, and he says, magic. That's what he says, it's magic. Let me warn you guys, save yourself all the grief. Break up those guy wires. That's where the problem was. God knows what it causes besides that. That was one. Then I'll tell you another one. Over.
Yeah, TVI can come from a lot of different things. Or telephone and telephone, radio, phonograph, telephone interference, television interference. Many cases, this is simple RF overload, and if you're radiating enough signal close enough to a very susceptible piece of electronics, until you correct the problem in the electronics, the problem may not go away. And if he just made a change to his guy wires, and now the neighbor who is getting the TVI is not complaining anymore, there's a lot of variables involved there. was the neighbor tuned to the same channel? Was his antenna aimed in the same direction? Was he on the same band running the same power? Yeah, he made a lot of changes. I could also wait until it was a different portion of the sunspot cycle, and I could say the sunspot cycle was causing it. So, with the darn many variables involved, and he thinks the guy wires fixed it. I won't say it's impossible, but boy, I'm skeptical. Back to you, Mel.
He swore by it. He says the guy wires, he says it was the magic fix. He says they had tried, he tried everything to get rid of his TVI situation, and he could not get rid of it. With every kind of method that everybody suggested, until this one person came and looked up there and said, there's your problem, the guy wires. He looked at him, he says, very, very suspicious. He says, but I was so desperate. He says that when I did take care of the guy wire situation, according to the way they tell you to do it in the ARRL book, he says, that's what he said I should follow. And he says, I followed it to a T. He said, this was my last shot, and he says, it did the job. No problems whatsoever, same rig, same power, same antenna, same height, same everything, just, it just went away, so. Maybe, well, I couldn't say, Dick, I couldn't, you know, I couldn't say anything to the man that he's so happy over.
But he's happy, and I hope he doesn't come back. I hope his TBI doesn't go into remission. Or, you know what I mean. Is remission, yeah, I think when your cancer goes into remission, that's good. Or when it comes back, what do they call that? Back to you, Mel.
Another one was with a bulletin, okay? I got from Mosley. Now, I had told you a story with my involvement with Mosley, and I would call Mosley. And so he sent me a lot of information, quite a bit. He was very happy with some of the ideas, input ideas I gave him about antennas and things. So he was quite friendly, and he was able to sell me a lot of materials and things. And I built a number of antennas, the Aggies, with his materials and all. And I get a bulletin from him, and I read it to the guys there. I says, have you ever heard this one? And the bulletin was that people complained about a number of his antennas, which were considered quite well made. I mean, he was battling, of course, back and forth with Telrex. He was a big competitor, and that was the competition at that time was because the government was using a lot of VHF and, of course, low band and, you know, antennas at that time. And the contracts, you know, went out. You know about those contracts for all those the silo installations for antennas, for actually HF antennas. And guess what he said was one of the things he cautioned everybody about? Guy wires on the tower. You guessed, Dick.
So Mosley was also saying you got to break up the guy wires in order to make the antenna work well, put a stop TVI. I'd love to know the mechanism, but that's true.
DC2 QFQ.
Go ahead, Glenn.
I have an opinion about this, and here again, I'm not sure it's 100%, but I think there's a lot to be said about this, that if you have a good station ground, in other words, especially on HF, and your transceiver has a very, very good, you know, earth ground, and you have good ground stakes as your transmission lines leave the shack, and your power lines don't have RF on them, things like that nature. All these kind of problems with pickup and strange antenna patterns and TBI all tend to go away. But here again, I don't think that I would want to mess with the guy wires. In other words, the first thing I would always want to make sure of is the integrity of the ground of those guy wires to make sure that that tower stays up there in the, underneath the strong wind loads and that kind of thing. And as far as TBI and antenna patterns and things like that, I probably want to look more carefully into the transmission line, how it terminates into the shack, and the grounding of the transceiver, and the grounding in general of the you know, of the station. Here again, just an opinion, but that's kind of what I've observed over time. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, go ahead, Glenn. grounding when it comes to lightning protection and human protection is extremely important and a good thing to do. And when it comes to radio performance, improving with ground, it can't hurt. And there are lots of people who believe that good grounding not only increases the radio performance, but lowers the TVI. Could be, but I haven't run the experiment, so I'm not sure. I wonder if some of the guys at the Kings County Radio Club have run experiments along those lines.